Negotiations had not failed when the United States and Israel began bombing Iran on Saturday. War is now spreading across the Middle East. Israel has troops poised once again on the Lebanon border. God knows where we'll be in 24 hours. But for crucial help on that front, we've called in Bruce Shapiro. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here as always.
Bruce, what is America making of this war?
America is making the same muddle of it as the rest of the world, I think. I think, you know, no one really understands what the rationale is. Clearly, the timing of it serves President Trump very well, coming right on the heels of the State of the Union and at a moment when his ratings are in the tank, when he's increasingly in trouble with big parts of his electorate going into, you know, the midterms. It serves him conveniently, just as it conveniently serves, you know, Bibi Netanyahu in Israel, who gets to claim the death of an epic opponent on the eve of the Purim holiday, which celebrates historically the death of an epic opponent. But I look, within American politics, you're seeing gradations of response. There's the MAGA corner, the pro-Trump corner that is will simply celebrate anything this president does. Among Democrats, you're seeing near universal condemnation of the failure to consult Congress. You know, the war power is delegated to Congress under the Constitution. The War Powers Act, passed during the Vietnam era, amplifies that. Clear lack of doing that, clear lack of declaration of an imminent threat, despite and no evidence of that. But, you know, presidents before have run roughshod over that. Among Democrats, you're seeing emerging subtle divisions. You've got a significant number of them who are simply saying this is a violation of law and is making America's role in the world more dangerous, and it's about a president seizing power. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Eric Swalwell, others have come forward with that. You're also seeing the more hawkish Democrats and those most closely associated with Israel playing a slightly different game, emphasizing the constitutional issues, but sort of holding their fire on the war's ends. You're also seeing some divisions in the MAGA base. After all, President Trump ran for office on the disillusionment with foreign wars and nation building, right? Yet here yes. We are in the middle of a massive exercise, if not in nation building, then in regime destruction. You know, what you're not hearing, I think, unfortunately, in my view, is a lot of historical perspective. You're not hearing a lot of recollection that this is actually the latest chapter in a decades-old struggle over Iraq that goes back to the U.S.'s role in fomenting the overthrow of Mossadegh.
Yeah, Iran.
Elected. Iran. In Iran, sorry. Yes. The overthrow of Mossadegh, the repressive regime of the Shah, which was installed by the United States, followed then by the repressive theocratic dictatorship of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Ayatollah Khomeini and then Ayatollah Khamenei,
yes.
Now late and unlamented. You know, that history, and you're also not hearing a whole lot about the much more recent history of the post 9/11 war powers vote. I think we will see a war powers vote in Congress, and it will be very interesting to see how a generation of politicians, some of whom grew up, came into public life after serving in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan
yes.
will reflect on their experience and the willingness back in 2001 of Democrats who knew better to fold their cards in the face of a dangerous war that was designed to simply restore U.S. unilateral power. So, you know, there's a lot going on.
But Bruce,
how is? Yeah.
Sorry, but I was just wondering, can there be any real confidence in the United States of America that their country is able to produce benign regime change in another country? I mean, after the failure in Afghanistan, after the failure in Iraq, and there's not even any notion at the moment anyway of putting boots on the ground in Iran, how can Americans believe for a moment that this could lead to this, you know, a gorgeous liberal capitalist a regime in Iran?
Look, Trump is counting on the very short memory. And by short, I mean really short. He is depicting this as kind of Venezuela 2.0. We can quickly go in, depose a leader, and I think he expects declare victory and withdraw. Okay. That's what I think in a couple of interviews he's hinted at is his strategy. Of course, that's not the case in Iran. Iran has a deep, multi-layered, very wealthy, very complex theocratic regime that has plenty of replacements for its leaders and plenty of deep structure within the society. Indeed, the nation-building kind of, or the regime destruction exercise that Trump seems to be calling on the Iranian people to engage in is going to be a long and difficult struggle if it were to happen. So, there is no memory. No one is discussing Vietnam, let alone yeah. Afghanistan, let alone Iraq. This is a president who lives in the present tense of reality TV. And clearly he thinks that having unleashed violence in Venezuela and made a deal with a corrupt repressive regime to keep it in place, he may be able to do the same thing here. That's not very likely.
What do we know had been settled in the negotiations before the bombing started?
Well, it's difficult to know. We know that the Oman intermediary had said there was progress. We know that in the past, in the Obama administration, there had been a successful nuclear deal with Iran, which the first Trump administration ripped up, and we are, in some ways we're set on the road to this war by Trump administration one, right? But on the other hand, we also have to know that both sides in this, do a lot of lying, right? I mean, certainly the Iranian government had been for years hiding elements of its nuclear strategy, and it's hiding its nuclear facilities from inspectors. And on the other hand, President Trump lied about after the attack last year about the depth of destruction. He claimed he obliterated Iran's nuclear program. No, he weakened it. He didn't obliterate it. So we don't really know where things were. We do know that people were talking, and talking is what you want when there's negotiation going on. We also know that it appears that on this, as on so many other matters, President Trump has been a bad faith negotiator. And one of the, I think, longer consequences of this, even if the war with Iran were settled tomorrow, is there is now nobody internationally who can trust the United States to be an honest broker in any conversation. And that is non-trivial damage in the world of international diplomacy.
Indeed, why would you sit down with this man, knowing that all serious negotiations that he's been conducting recently have ended with him bombing someone? It's not...
The president, the self-declared president of peace, has actually gone to war 7 times since resuming office. So, but look, in this matter, as in domestic matters, this is all about the unilateral authority, not just of the United States, which was the kind of Dick Cheney version of American unilateralism after 9/11. This is about the unilateral authority of the autocrat president to go to war first and ask questions later. This is further escalation of the kind of violence that we've seen on the one hand in the international arena, now through Iran, through Venezuela, et cetera, but that we've seen domestically through the deployment of ICE as a political police force around the United States. This is an autocratic president whose use of violence, both domestically and internationally, is escalating. And that is the reality that we're going to live with again, even if the Iran war were to be wound down in days. We are living with a president who's increasingly deploying high levels of violence to achieve his ends without feeling the need to make an argument to Congress, without feeling the need to explain any imminent threat. And we're seeing this going into a critical swing election in which the president's party is likely to lose.
Bruce, there is a bit of to and fro, isn't there, on the role of Congress here? Because while Congress, under the Constitution, has the power to declare war, it hasn't done so, as I understand it, for any of the wars that America has fought since the Second World War.
Well, there was a War Powers Resolution that was voted after 9/11, looking back, in fact, at Vietnam and the failure of Congress to assert its authority there. The War Powers Resolution that was voted after 9/11, that sent us to war in Afghanistan, came to be one that many Democrats decided to regret. Right. I mean, Joe Biden looked back on it one of the worst mistakes of his career. What you see in these crucial moments, right, just as you saw in the Vietnam era after the Gulf of Tonkin crisis, is politicians, Democrats, moderate Republicans who know better, nonetheless being afraid to push back when U.S. military forces are actually engaged in action or seem to be in harm's way. There is still that, in many quarters, that instinctive fear to go too far in criticizing the military during active war. I think that this adventure, which is going to so roil not only the Mideast, but look, the American economy, the price of oil is going to go up. All kinds of other issues are going to arise as in consequence of this. This is going to test that. And I do think that we'll see growing pressure, not only from Democrats, but from anti-Trump Republicans for a War Powers Resolution. And the fascinating thing will be to see, under the War Powers Act, if there is a resolution, who votes for continuing the war, who says this is a bad idea, and how Trump will respond to that is also interesting. I mean, I think we can expect that Trump will ignore a War Powers resolution, yet we do have Congress, being sidelined. Look, in last week's Supreme Court decision about tariffs, the most notable concurring opinion was from Trump's own appointee, Justice Gorsuch, who quite elaborately went to town on the diminution of the role of Congress under this administration and the failure to consult or engage in Congress and Congress's refusal to stand up for itself. That was at the heart of the tariff decision, one instrument of global policy. Exactly the same dynamic is at work here.
A few moments we have left. It's been reported since we last spoke that a dossier relating to Trump is missing from the files, the Department of the Epstein files that the Department of Justice has released. Is this the serious problem for Trump finally emerging in the Epstein files?
We don't know, right? And I want to be careful here because there are also plenty of unfounded accusations in the Epstein files. I think the Epstein files are so important because they are a continual reminder of the linking of economic inequality, power manipulation, and gender violence and exploitation at the very height, at the pinnacle of American power and elite money, exactly Donald Trump's world. Okay, Donald Trump, the man who is trafficked in conspiracy theories, remains caught in the web of this, regardless of whether this particular allegation turns out to be substantive, or if, as you know, some in the Justice Department are now saying, it's simply a repetition of something that already existed in other documents and was unfounded. We don't know. What we do know is that the continuing frustration over the Epstein files is continues to split Trump's MAGA base, cuts across party lines in a way because it goes to the heart of the tangled mess that inequality has made of American politics.
Is there commentary in the United States looking across the Atlantic to the fact that people in Britain have been charged with crimes for what's emerged in papers?
Oh, yes.
Nothing in America. Nothing.
There's certainly a lot of awareness and a lot of frustration that the indictments, that the arrests, not yet indictments, the arrests of Andrew and the arrests of Peter Mendelsohn, represent an action in France, all represent justice systems in Europe moving far faster. Of course, the U.S. Justice Department in the United States is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Donald Trump, even to the extent of hanging his picture from the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., looking out on the street. So I don't think anyone has any great expectations that Pam Bondi is suddenly going to start charging Donald Trump's inner circle. But look, this is now not only a kind of bizarre, epic political scandal. It also forms the backdrop of war. And this war, among its many purposes, is further distraction from Donald Trump's domestic problems, which very much include the Epstein file. So, you know, this war is, as they say in psychiatry, overdetermined, right? but one of those overdetermined factors is very much a weakening autocrat's desire to distract public attention and hold on to power.
Is there anyone in America who is saying, look, mate, you wouldn't go to war yourself? You know, you had bone spurs in your feet and you couldn't serve in Vietnam, and now look at you running all these wars.
Well, I certainly think that the generation of Democrats in Congress, also some Republicans in Congress, but Democrats in Congress who are combat veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, who saw their sisters and brothers bleed, and who also became very aware that they were dying and risking their lives for ultimately a chaotic and failed mission, are beginning to articulate a generational vision and a generational frustration that we'll be hearing about in the coming weeks.
Thank you, Bruce, once again for joining us on Late Night Live. Bruce Shapiro, our man in America.